Hello and welcome. This is News Club. I'm your host, Barlow, and I'm joined today by Debs and Tom. And this is the place where we ask the important question, got news? What we really try to do is we try to talk about the news and what we can do about it. We know in this world that basically news seems to be something that happens to us. It's something that if we can ever be bothered to pay attention to, it feels like something is overwhelming us and is being done to us by others. And that's something we want to change right here, right now. And we will usually each week talk about an area of broadcast and press, an area of social media and tech, and an area where people are actually really making change. And we'd really like to start with where people are making change. That's the positive note we'd like to begin with. But this week, the week of Trump's inauguration, we have to start with the TikTok ban, Musk, and the social media douchebags that may destroy the entire planet. Debs, Tom, you on board with that? Does that sound like fun to you?
I love talking about billionaire douchebags, so absolutely. Let's get going.
Yeah, I mean, it's only upwards from there, right?
Yeah, we will end on, in each segment, some notes, not only of positivity, but constructive things that, you know, you and I can do and make happen. But let's dive into it. Look, what was the TikTok ban? What's happening now? And what does this really tell us about the world? That's what we're going to talk about now. First and foremost, over the past couple of weeks, if you were on TikTok, you'd have been very, very aware that the TikTok ban is drawing near. If you were not, then you probably don't know what was going on. To be honest, you might have heard some murmurings because the TikTok ban was only in the US. It'd gone through every sort of formal procedure through the American government and high courts. And it basically, it'd come to a point where the appeal process, where TikTok was saying, please don't ban us. Don't let American users use this. And the American government was saying, you're owned by China. You're bad guys. We're going to ban you. Eventually came to the point where there was no appeals left and everyone on the app lost their mind temporarily. First and foremost, Debs and Tom, or Debs in fact, is that your understanding of what happened, how the ban happened in a really broad and simplistic
fashion? I'm glad you kept me out of that because I've been averse to using TikTok at all. So I've just sort of been witnessing this from both across the Atlantic and completely away from TikTok altogether.
Well, it's obviously, and we'll get into it, there's this funny thing of strange bedfellows, right? Because Trump was the first person to suggest banning TikTok, and then it got taken up by the Democrats. And now, obviously, Trump has done this U-turn and decides that he likes it. But yeah, there's a bit of a tussle of like, how does an increasingly authoritarian US government feel about, you know, this other authoritarian government that maybe they want to have a war with? And how does that play out in the space of these massive platforms that otherwise the US government kind of knows that it doesn't have them under its thumb, but it has a different kind of relationship than is possible with one that has significant like buy-in from Beijing.
So there was, as the ban drew near, there was a lot of Americans sort of saying goodbye to their Chinese spy and saying how much they'll miss them. and Chinese people coming on and saying, you know, hey, Peter in New York, you need to stop drinking Pepsi so much. It's bad for your health. And Alice in Texas, you got to dump him. He doesn't really love you, you know, and some good natured banter. And then people started to join Red Note, which is literally, you know, a term in reference to the little red book that Mao had. Right. So America, through the TikTok ban, had managed to force millions of its own populace onto a Chinese owned app that was openly communist and state owned. And people would be coming back from it and reporting and going, have you seen how much food Chinese people can eat? Like, they go shopping. You can just watch them buying food. Like, we could never afford that here. They don't work two jobs. One of the common questions was to Americans as they joined the app from Chinese people, is it true you actually have to pay for your healthcare and ambulances? Or is that government propaganda that our government is lying to us about, right? Because they didn't believe it. I mean, who would, right? If you didn't know it and you lived in an authoritarian regime where your government regularly lies to you. And Americans were like, oh my God, they're dissing us and they don't even know it. So then people were coming back onto TikTok, unfurling the Chinese flag and like sort of doing salutes to the Chinese national anthem. And you have this rare moment because of this ban where ordinary people start talking to each other and having fun and being quite nice to each other and realizing, oh, hey, we're just humans. And so that was one of the wonderful outcomes of the approaching ban. Did you see any of those things from the outside, Tom C?
I didn't know. I mean, I saw the reporting on the upcoming ban and then suddenly the dramatic, or perhaps not so dramatic, turn at the last minute by President Trump. What's really interesting for me in what comes next for TikTok, especially since Trump has now said, oh, I love TikTok, it's my best friend, it helped me win the election. What we really need to see happen next is that it gets bought by the American state, that it becomes a 50% owned partnership between, I think he said something like between chosen preferred American businesses will own 50% of it and the American government will own the other 50%. I think that's probably what's going to happen next, based on everything we've seen with the development of the previous large platforms, when once upon a time they were seen as these revolutionary new technologies and hugely liberating, democratizing spaces for personal expression, very quickly turned by corporate capture and commercial control and advertising and data capture into slop, into shit platforms that are there to just exploit their users to make money for other people. Is that what's going to happen to TikTok next? Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. What's your reading on it, Debs? How's it appear to you? I'm an avid TikTok user, so I'm inside it and have feelings, and maybe I'm not as distant from it as I should be. So are you slightly more distant?
I'm definitely more distant, but I think it's really interesting what you're saying about these brief moments for some genuine transnational relationship building, because one of the theories about why the Democrats were pushing so hard on this, say a year ago, was actually because TikTok was one of the places where the youth of America was actually coming to understand what was happening in Gaza in a much more realistic way than they were through, certainly obviously through their mainstream media channels. There's like such a deep irony that this creation coming from China that has these links to the Chinese state is actually for certain things and in certain respects might have been a better source of understanding what was happening on the ground in Gaza than any other platform in the US at that time. So it's very interesting that then this next chapter has included also a kind of transnational communication that was clearly not at all what was intended.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't. One of the things that occurred was in the lead up to the ban, all US users were given a post that said, we are working with the excellent or brilliant or something positive President Trump. We're working with the brilliant President Trump on this issue and we hope to turn the ban back. And then when the ban was revoked 24 hours later, or rather the blackout, because the ban hasn't been revoked, there's now a 90-day period and we're going to see what happens, it was all the American users have gone, thanks to the fantastic President Trump, you can now access TikTok again. But users and creators on the platform are reporting that they can't see anything from the protests outside the inauguration. They are having to manually allow comments that say anything negative about President Trump or the establishment or billionaires. And again, you know, TikTok had been such a pivotal platform, not for criticisms of Trump, but for support of Luigi Mangione, who's the person accused of killing a healthcare CEO. Tom, what I'd like to bring you in on this and then Debs is, how does this relate to Zuckerberg's announcement?
I guess the background to this is that in a similar vein of within the last sort of 14 days before Trump came back into power, there seemed to be, or the sort of interpretation was, there was a mad scramble from corporate America. And we saw this across lots of major American employers abandoning their kind of diversity and inclusion schemes. TikTok obviously sort of praising Trump for reversing the ban. And then within that same period, we had Mark Zuckerberg's Meta scrapping many of the policies around content moderation and fact-checking that they had had in place on large parts of the global Meta platform, but in particular on the US platform, revoking some of those policies under the auspices of these processes haven't worked, they've been stifling free expression and not producing the kind of outcomes for community discussion and participation that we wanted on the platform. All this kind of just obvious bullshit designed to explain away why Musk is cutting back a lot of funding. Basically just an opportunity to save money on employing fact checkers or paying content moderators. But then, yeah, so then Zuckerberg went on the Joe Rogan Experience podcast to explain why he did this, but to do it in a way that was very much pitched towards the kind of MAGA moment in the build-up to Trump taking back power. So talking about how content moderation had allowed liberal biases to seep in, claiming that it had basically allowed a lot of state propaganda around COVID and mask mandates, and basically questioning the rigor and rigidity of the scientific process. And there was a particular interesting part in there where he spoke about, oh, you know, what we want is platforms that are free from political foreign interference, from meddling, from disinformation. But what we also see our role is as major strategic partners in the US's global interests, as a major strategic power. So in one breath, he's saying that Facebook wants to be free from political interference while basically offering up his platforms and his infrastructure to the new US administration in ways that we know they've already been doing.
So Debs, I mean, what we're seeing here is potentially not only a move to save money, but a new form of sort of social media imperialism that is not only intimately tied to the American state, but maybe also intimately tied to one particular person within the American state, the president. Because before, ultimately, they were serving security services and the Department of Defense and sort of, you know, institutions. But in this case, it seems to be very clear that this is all, you know, friends with benefits situations with Donald Trump here. Like, is that the way that you see it? And could you also maybe talk to, like, what are the real world consequences for, like, ordinary people when this stuff goes down, you know?
Yeah, I mean, when I said earlier that, you know, it's not exactly that the platforms are under the thumb of the US government, I mean, it could be that you see it as more that the US government is under the thumb of the platforms, or that they're all just in, you know, such a revolving door. I mean, everything's dependent on the Starlink infrastructure that Elon Musk has built, for example. So how can we even separate out what is kind of the state or private enterprise? I think we have to see this also as a continuous process. Like, there was a point in the late 2010s when Meta was claiming some kind of level of corporate social responsibility, I guess. And this was in the wake of what had happened in Myanmar and the genocide of the Rohingya people. It was in the wake of things that had happened in the Philippines. Like, there were these clearly documented examples of where Facebook had been used by states to foment violence. And as well as, like, ongoing cases around the safety of Instagram for young people. And there was this kind of claim of, like, well, we do care about our users and we care about providing a safe space. And they brought in a kind of, you know, their trust and safety teams and content moderation of different kinds. And the point at which that actually was massively cut was when interest rates rose. And so actually now this, like, removal of even the basics of certain kinds of content moderation or fact checking is part of a, you know, there's been a downward slide since, you know, since for the last couple of years, which is largely to do with the economics of it. And that in so many ways says, like, it's not actually possible to have a platform of this kind of size and scope with this many people interacting with this much, you know, the speed and the volume of it, to make it a safe space in the most basic of ways. It's not actually possible on a profit-making model. So if we want to have these kinds of things, they actually need to have some other different form of funding. But in general, I mean, in terms of what the user is going to experience on this, I mean, this is also coinciding with Meta saying that they're going to roll out loads more AI personas on their platforms. The experience will be that it is less interesting, less relevant, less fun. There's more adverts. And occasionally you also might see something that's actually really gross and shocking and nobody has removed it. And generally they will, the most people's experience of it will just be that it has got shitter.
Yeah, which is a beautiful segue into inshittification before we then talk about what to do about this. So inshittification, if you haven't come across the term, is a great way. Is it Cory Doctorow? I can't remember yet, who said, basically, and we've all seen this, right? Uber's a great example. It's a really, really great service whilst it's been pumped full of funding. So it offers it as cheap as possible. Social media, Facebook in the early days, Twitter in the early days, when it's free to use for anyone, there's no adverts, there's no algorithms really either trying to shape your feed or anything like that. And so these were like the first 5 years of Facebook were absolutely brilliant, right? For anyone who's around for that, and then they become inshittified because the need to make money destroys them. It not only pumps it full of ads, but it creates algorithms that draws your attention to things that they want you to see, and that's sometimes to make money, that's sometimes to keep you on the platform in an addictive fashion, and sometimes that's on behalf of the American state or whoever's backing them to squash certain things or promote other things, right? Instagram has very much become that way. This is one of the big things that's taken away from TikTok, is that the TikTok, American TikTok users and creators were like, I'd rather go onto a Chinese-owned state app that's a communist-run and is called Red Note than I would go onto Instagram. And the weird thing about TikTok was, despite it having lots of foreign investment, was it was still, 40% owned, I think, by the Chinese state. It didn't have to make money. It just had to be good at what it does. And within China, for instance, there's limits on using TikTok. You can only use it an hour a day, I think. It promotes very heavily educational content and learning content and stuff like that. So you can create things, the social media that actually is social and is beneficial for, like, you know, the public space and for us to spend time with each other. But instead, we're all developing phone addictions to horrendous slop that makes money for billionaires who are in hock to the, you know, the American imperial state.
Yeah, I think it's basically the only way to start looking for alternatives to the kind of catastrophically shit digital environment that we've been left with by the major players. We're going to be stuck in this endless cycle of things getting worse and governments not really having any power to do something about it.
Yeah, and we're going to come back to BBC because that's the next segment, and Media Commons, I think, discuss it more concretely. But what can you do as an individual? I think we have to be aware, and we haven't mentioned yet, that Musk did two Nazi salutes, you know, on the presidential platform. He's not only a co-owner of the presidency right now and of all the satellite infrastructure and obviously of Twitter, right? But he's a Nazi. His granddad, it has been revealed this week and it's been talked about a long time ago, moved from Canada to South Africa because he had been imprisoned during the Second World War for being a Nazi sympathizer, and moved to South Africa because he thought it was the forefront of global Nazism, right? That's it, the family that he comes from. And, you know, we have to be aware that, you know, no one accidentally, certainly not twice, does a Hitler salute. Right. Like, so what do we do? I mean, I think first and foremost is you have to give up Twitter. You're just going to have to do it. And you're probably going to have to give up Instagram and Facebook. We're going to have to seriously consider all personally getting off them and encouraging institutions to get off them. And, you know, writing to media outlets or companies that we work with and say, can you not operate on there?
I think there's definitely an element of that. And like, yeah, that kind of encouragement of these are toxic platforms. They are not benefiting us and they are harming others and moving away from them, in the spirit of attempting to find and build public alternatives, is the only way to go. But the people who are harmed by those media outlets and the people who will continue to be harmed and attacked and delegitimized and suppressed on the online spaces by the likes of Musk, by the changes in the algorithms by Zuckerberg, are still going to suffer from those harms and those consequences of these platforms. So I think as well as the efforts to move away from them, there has to be a kind of building of solidarity and support for the groups that will continue to be the victims of what these platforms do, whether they're on them or not.
Yeah, Debs, would you tend to agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely approaching it more from the institutional side than the individual side. And then, yeah, I think that thing of like talking to institutions and saying like this is an ethical issue and a practical issue of like if you're having a divestment policy from fossil fuels, or you're saying that you wouldn't just like have, you know, advertising for cigarettes around your university campus, like, well, why do they have a Facebook account, why do they have an Instagram account? These are definitely, and you know, this is stuff that actually we've been talking about for a number of years, but the clear alignment now of these tech billionaires with a Trump presidency just makes that argument much, much stronger. And I think when you start seeing the organizations and the institutions that claim to have some kind of values basis moving en masse off of these platforms, that will have much more impact, obviously, than individual users.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think you're right. If you can make noise, you know, if you're just like constantly going on there every day, you shouldn't be on here. And there are a lot of sympathetic voices. We have those conversations within public institutions, universities, councils, you know, and other NGOs, other things. They're already going, we need to maybe get off here. Okay, in that zone, one of the things we talked about, Tom, is how state-owned things can often provide something that the market doesn't. The Charter Review is a really interesting discussion, because is the BBC state-owned? Is it an arm of the British state, a propaganda organisation? Should it exist? Should we change it? What's going on, Tom?
What we've seen over the last 2 weeks is the consequences of building a news and information space that's entirely without any kind of public controls or even basic democratic accountability. Now, arguably, this has always been the case, right? I mean, the news media, what you can call mainstream news media, the corporate newspapers, broadcasters, established professional journalism, kind of always largely been shaped by dominant corporate interests, partnering up with state power, shutting out the public from having any kind of direct role or say in the kind of news that's being produced. And clearly that's even more the case now with these kind of big tech empires run by the likes of Zuckerberg and Musk. I mean, that's why it's so important to talk about public alternatives to big tech and to corporate media, and how we can build those kinds of models and infrastructure for news and information that actually serves the public interest. Why I want to talk about Charter Review and some of the kind of recent reporting, particularly in the UK national press, about those debates and decisions about the BBC is because that not only do we not have the spaces of public media to have that kind of news and information, we don't even have the spaces to debate it or talk about it or consider it. And that's what we're seeing with Charter Review. So as a very quick explainer, BBC's founded on a royal charter. This is both kind of the constitution of the BBC, so how it's structured and governed as a public body. Now, the charter has an expiry date, which at the moment is the end of 2027. So after 10 years, or in this case 11 years, because of some very boring political decisions that were made last time, the Royal Charter is about to be renewed for a new term. And then before that, the government gets to decide what the new terms of the Royal Charter should be. Now, you might think this would be an amazing opportunity for a huge public debate, a massive participatory public exercise about what the BBC is, how it served the public, what kind of services people like from the BBC or what they don't like, how the BBC should be funded, how much we should pay for it, what kind of BBC the public might want to have in the future. But having that kind of public debate has just never been the case, right? Charter Review has always been this ultra-private, unaccountable, state-led system of private negotiations, totally unaccountable political pressure and kind of arm-twisting. So with that Charter Review debate on the horizon, what we're now starting to see is the beginnings of kind of public and press attention towards what is the BBC going to be and what should Charter Review be, which is where I've kind of picked out this article from the Sunday Times with the title, "The License Fees Clock is Ticking and What is Lisa Nandy's Plan to Reform the BBC?"
So, Debs, you've worked quite a lot on a Media Commons. do you think like the way Tom's framed this is kind of accurate, like that we have quite an opaque discussion, if any discussion, about the BBC and the Charter Review? For most people, this will be the first time they've even heard what it really is. And when that discussion does come, it comes from organisations that have a vested interest in changing it to benefit them. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's just such a massive disconnect between the kind of day-to-day chat about what the BBC is, what it's for, how people feel about it, and what the institution understands. And that's not to say, you know, people obviously have very, very different views about the BBC. There is no consensus about it. But I think there's a real institutional instinct to discount certain kinds of views on it. So for example, so I work at the People's Newsroom Initiative with Shirish Kulkarni, and he's based in Cardiff and did some research with the BBC there, with people in Grangetown talking about their views of the BBC. And what they heard from people there was they really disliked it because of its political coverage. They felt really alienated from it. They felt like it completely misrepresented them and their communities. But they also did have, and that lots of them admitted to not paying the license fee and said that this was the reason why, because they didn't like the political coverage. But then when they also asked, like, would you like, what are your ideas for it? The ideas that they had were, well, what if you had community reporters come and talk to us? What if they came and were part of things where we have like local representatives, and it's actually part of building kind of democratic accountability in our in the place that we live? Like, what if that was the function of the BBC? And when, you know, when he described these views, I was like, yeah, that sounds to me like a lot of what people I know say about the BBC or how they feel about it. And the BBC, having commissioned this research, then he got in a massive tussle with them about whether they would even publish the report. Mm-hmm. So there's this real institutional, and it's like, it's so often it's just its own worst enemy, because it's failure to even sort of acknowledge or accept that these things might be true for a whole bunch of people means that it can't really take seriously the criticisms, and it also can't listen to the solutions that people are coming up with, which I was like, that sounds like a great idea.
So Tom, is that your experience with BBC? Because you've tried to work on changing it and on Lisa and Andy. And if so, what is it that we and the listeners can do about that?
I mean, we're working on at the Media Reform Coalition a pamphlet on mutualisation. This is an idea that even Lisa Nandy herself talked about a lot when she was standing to be Labour leader. It's something she's brought up again now. She is the culture secretary in charge of BBC Charter Review, which is, well, why don't we make it change the way the BBC is structured so that it is owned by licence fee payers, so that the members of the BBC who funded and are part of it have an active and direct role in the day-to-day running of the BBC, its strategy, in advising on its editorial direction, in actually having some kind of accountability and participation over what the BBC is doing. I mean, the way we talk about that is we have those exact kind of conversations, and we go to these kind of elite policymakers and BBC figures and say, what would be so wrong with that? What is it about the BBC that we, as the public, wouldn't be able to manage on our own terms and be involved in? Tom Mills, the chair of the MRC, was invited on the media show to talk about mutualisation, and he went through these ideas of where you could have panels that were staffed by members of the public who had an active and direct role in advising the BBC on how they want Brexit to be discussed or how climate change should be covered in its reporting. And the two BBC, or the BBC host and the guest they had on, were completely kind of baffled by this concept. They were saying, well, how would that even work? What, you would just ask people their opinions and get them involved and make them sort of contribute? That sounds absolutely insane. You know, there is this real reluctance from not just kind of the, you know, right-wing commercial interests and the government, but even from a kind of cozy liberal establishment, that if all you did, you know, all you need to do is give the BBC a bit more money, tidy up some of the government, get some of the, you know, old Tory appointments out, and everything would be fine. There's a real lack of understanding that there's this widespread public dissatisfaction, not just from the left and the right, but from the general public as licence fee payers, that the BBC isn't serving them. It's a public service in name and nothing more. And unless you are going to investigate these kind of new transformative ways of changing the BBC into something that's owned, operated and kind of governed by the public that funds it, then there's kind of no future left. What I've been thinking is that this charter review is going to be one way or another the last charter review of the BBC, right? Because either we transform it into an entirely new kind of institution that's run and led by the public, or the current government just tinkers around the edges like what has always happened in the past, and then at the next charter review, it's simply torn apart because the service is so dissatisfactory. So this is the last chance to kind of, I don't want to say save the BBC, because the BBC we have now perhaps isn't worth saving. It's the last chance to transform this institution we already have into something that's genuinely publicly owned and democratic.
And like, you don't have to be a bleeding heart lefty or liberal or whatever to get this. There's like, there was a report written by a guy called Jaffet Asher, who used to be, I think, head of BBC Children's for a while. What he was saying was, we need to make the BBC more participatory, because that is what young people expect from media. That is what they are experiencing in gaming. That's what they're experiencing on social media platforms. And the more we do not allow this, the more this just becomes this like really outdated, really like jarring experience.
And in particular, does it in a way that isn't, you know, you're right to say that, you know, the modern media environment, its kind of structures and its formats is built around participation and the feeling that you are in control of what you're seeing, what you're doing, and that you can do something yourself. But so much of that is controlled by commercial imperatives and profit and giant corporate overlords who will either sort of boost your content because they like it or throw it down the back of the cupboard because they don't like it and it's not making them any money. We need that kind of public alternative which provides those spaces for kind of participatory, engaged media, but which isn't governed by commercial imperatives and actually has some kind of public purpose behind it. This is a thing I've been banging the drum about with my conversations with people in the BBC and people in DCMS, and they're sort of starting to get it. They're starting to grasp that, oh yeah, there is this real existential turning point, not just for the BBC, but kind of our idea of media as a whole, in that it has moved away from this model of broadcast, that there are these sort of esteemed institutions that report the news, give you content, create culture, and the public just enjoy it. Now the system is built around much more kind of reflexivity and engagement and actually having to go to the audiences themselves and get them involved. If the public media institutions aren't going to do that in a way that's democratic, then the commercial media players will simply swamp the space and make a load of money off of it and diminish any opportunities we have for alternatives.
The BBC has kind of hung itself. It is being cut to shreds by the governments of the past 15 years, but also has not done anything that makes it appealing, as you say, for 6 to 25 year olds. You know, it does produce, I still think, some of the best light entertainment in the world, but that's largely targeted at boomers, you know, who are still watching analog TV. And in 10 to 15 years, that demographic isn't really going to exist. And what is then, who is the BBC going to be for? What you could say, you know, is a purely technological rather than a political innovation, could be something like a TikTok for BBC users, where young users can make educational videos for each other, you know, about science and music, creativity as well. And again, I'd love to see Britain, you know, I want our bread, I want our roses, I want our rent lower, but I'd like to have, you know, culture produced by British people that lifts us up, that moves us. And I think, you know, to give people some recommendations and then to talk about some activism, there is going to be the Media Democracy Festival on the 31st of May in London. I'm going to talk about it every week. Come down, get on it. There's going to be people talking about how we change things, what's wrong, how we change things. And it'll be a great chance to be with hundreds, if not maybe thousands of people who are looking to change the media. Join the News Club mailing list. Look out for future petitions around the BBC that actually look to change it in a positive way that gives us more control over it. Actually talk about the Charter Review on social media or with your mates. I know that's going to be a hard thing to do, but bring it up. Like, just say, you know, do it in a way that enthuses people. Say, wouldn't it be amazing if the BBC, you know, helped save all the club nights or the club venues, music venues in the country that are shutting down, and they were owned by the BBC? Wouldn't it be amazing if the BBC, our license fee, went to pay to create culture that we actually kind of, we made ourselves, like, you know. And also look out for the Media Reform Coalition, because they really work on this a lot, and you can join them and become a subscriber of them. So those are some things we can do. But what are some things, Debs, that other people are doing to change the world this week, our activist correspondent, Debs.
Well, the story I wanted to talk about has been covered in the in an investigation by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, El País and The Independent. And it's about a set of seasonal workers who came to the UK in 2023. These were from Latin America, from Bolivia, Chile, Haiti, and they came here on these seasonal work visas to do fruit picking. And they were promised, you know, up to £500 a week while they were here. And then when they came, they were not given shifts. And then they were being told that they needed to replay their flights, and their flights had these inflated costs. So they were essentially in a position of indentured labour. You know, you're not like a slave, but also you can't leave until you've done a whole bunch of work for free or very little. And so this group of workers, like 90 of them, got together, they made a list of demands, and then they did a walkout. Some of them were out for a few days, some were out for a week. Eventually, they did go back to work. They didn't really get their demands met, but they did get the true costs of their flights at least addressed. But now this group of people, you know, they've been trying to organise. It's the it's one of the first known walkouts from people on this particular kind of visa. They're obviously in a very precarious situation. They're often very isolated in different parts of the country. They might not speak English very well. And they're only here for a short period of time. So it's very, very difficult for them to organise. The Home Office has also looked into this. It has found like widespread exploitation, people, you know, living in caravans full of cockroaches or whatever. But he's obviously doing very little to address it. And then this group of people, you know, there have been some people trying to get organised. Some of those workers from 2023 are trying to go to an employment tribunal, having a protest this Friday on the 24th of January outside the Home Office. And I thought this was a really interesting story because it sort of gets at several things that our kind of mainstream media talk about extremely badly. So one is obviously around migration and how the conversation around migration just sort of falls into these ruts of like, well, you know, either migrants bad or we need them for the economy or whatever. And it's very rarely talking about what it's actually like to be a migrant worker in this country. And I also thought it was really interesting that they were also told a bunch of lies about what it would be like when they came here. And they were literally like, I wouldn't have come if I'd known that this was what it was going to be like. So there's this thing of that. There is a lot of propaganda about what the UK is like that is about there in the world. And a lot of people come on that basis. And when they arrive here, they're a bit like, I thought I was coming to like a functioning developed nation. And what I've come to is a place where like, the train is £100 and it doesn't even run and you can't get a seat. Like there's some very basic things about the texture of everyday life in this country, which are not great. And yeah, there's a lot of propaganda out there that is not representing that clearly. And then there's this other bit, which is about the food system and complete lack of discussion about where we're actually at with the food system. I mean, government policy for the last few decades has been we will import food. There's a real lack of long-term thinking about resilience. You know, last year was a terrible harvest. And one of the issues that these farm workers might face is that they're coming here expecting a certain amount of work, but then like the fruit hasn't grown. So there's nothing for them to pick. Or whatever, like, and it's amazing that this kind of thing is just not a story. Like, having a poor harvest, you would think was something that was actually quite a fundamental thing for people to know about. But all people might have seen is, you know, the cost of certain staples went up in the supermarket a bit. But yeah, this huge disconnect between most of the population and rural areas and food production, and this is going to become such a major issue. Over the next 10 years, like this question of food security. And then obviously the third element of it is around organising and the fact that these people like there's a group of people who stood up for themselves, who tried to take action together. Some of them are continuing to do that. And I don't think it's an accident that those people were from Latin America. There's very little representation of Latinx people in this country. But there's like a different culture around unionization, around resistance, around organizing that I think it's had a massive impact actually on the way, particularly on new unions being set up. The willingness to use kind of wildcat strike tactics, the willingness to just like get together and try something is really different than what you would see in the kind of mainstream unions. You know, Unite would never do this. And these workers were also being supported by the Land Workers Alliance, which was, you know, it's the UK branch of La Via Campesina, the worldwide peasants movement, which also came out of Latin America.
So a quick one for listeners just on that point, which is that wildcat strikes are strikes that are declared without due legal process. In the UK now, in particular, we have very strict anti-trade union laws that were passed, three different ones by Margaret Thatcher. Very specifically, what it gave the... it gave the government control of trade union bank accounts. And it said, if you don't play by the rules, if you don't obey the law, then we will freeze your money, which meant that you couldn't distribute strike funds. So, you know, you, me, we've all been putting into a pot saying that if we do go on strike, i.e. we stop working, the union pays us for the days that we're not working to help us cover those loss of earnings so that we can strike, still earn a wage, but our bosses don't get it, don't get all the profits that they get from our work, and eventually they back down and let us work in a place that's safer to work, that gives us, you know, a little bit more dignity, a little bit more control over it, maybe slightly better wages, you know, basic things that we're fighting for. Maybe though, and this is what had happened, it would happen, is we went on strike in solidarity with someone else. So for instance, in Scotland, in the shipbuilding yards, they refused to work on ships that were going to support Pinochet, who was a fascist dictator in Chile, right? And they said, we're doing this as a political strike or a solidarity strike. Thatcher was trying to stop workers from being able to work together and said, no, you only work in your own sector and you have to go through these laws. And what you have to do is you have to do a ballot of your members, and over 75% of them have to turn out for the ballot, and only over 75% of them have to vote for strike action. So it makes it far more democratic than our actual democratic system. Like, our democratic system is only about 20% of the people ever vote for the government who runs the country. But here, you know, almost all the members have to vote, and these are long protracted procedures. You have to go through a series of negotiations first. And so wildcat strike is saying, sod it, we don't care if you control our bank account, we don't care, we're going to go on strike because we want change now. We're not waiting months, sort this now or we're walking off and your fruit doesn't get picked, right? Your phones don't get answered, your machinery doesn't get built, your healthcare doesn't get done, your education doesn't get sorted, right? Like, that's what a wildcat strike is. It's saying, no, change now, we don't care about the consequences. And that means everyone walks out. If you're at a trade union in your work, dear listener, and they're going through all these procedures, two things to bear in mind. One, have some sympathy for the trade union organisers, because they don't want to go through this shit. You know, if you're thinking it's boring and it's ineffective, these laws are why, and it's something, by the way, that Labour promised to repeal, and we'll see whether that happens. But secondly, you can say to them, hey, is this so important that maybe we just walk out today? We just all get together and walk out today? Because what are they going to do? Okay, you know, like, the union's going to have problems, but the boss is going to have more problems. Why don't we just go? You know, so something to think about there. A nice lesson to have been learned. Tom, take us home. What final thoughts does this engender from you? Like, what brain cells does this spark when you hear stories like this?
Well, I think across all of the things we've talked about today, whether it's like, how do we build alternatives to big tech? How do we try and secure a collective and participatory future for public media? Or how do we support people who are in some of the most kind of precarious, abused, underpaid, exploited bits of labour that are basically holding up our modern society? I feel like, particularly in food resilience, we're living on borrowed time. And in a lot of the periods recently where there have been bad harvests. But again, you know, it's the sense that there's having to support systems of collective solidarity and going across and between these movements and finding ways that we can discover news about these stories that aren't being discussed in the mainstream media, that aren't being covered because they're not part of the stories that sort of the corporate press want to talk about. So finding these stories and recognizing that so much of our society is built on these people who are in very similar situations to us but exploited and hidden from view, and finding kind of union organizing, collective solidarity with these movements and building that across all of our different campaigns, I think is so essential.
Brilliant. So first off, join a union or support a union. Secondly, there's a protest this Friday. Look out for it. Share it with a couple of mates on WhatsApp when you see the link, a bit of news, because again, you'll be sending a signal to news organisations, oh, this is something we should cover more of, and that will help amplify it. Support the campaign any way that you can, if you can find it out. Again, we'll try and drop something in the link or in the description. And with all of these stories, we're going to keep building on them. We've done a lot of explainer stuff today, but we'll try and keep retouching base on, like, you know, food and energy and water systems, as well as media systems, and we'll keep talking about them, and we'll together all be learning more about how we can talk about things in a way that can create change, that we can look to the future with some positivity, because the world feels like it's declining right now. But actually, I have a lot of hope for 2025, because we've explored all the other options now. Now it's down to us to make some change. Thank you. That's all from me. That's all from Tom. Say goodbye, Tom.
Thanks. Goodbye.
And that's all from Debs. Say goodbye, yeah, Debs. Bye. And this is News Club, where we ask, got news? Right. Okay, that's it.